At my age, you don't like to see something shaped like that drooping. I hadn't thought about that, but at the luncheon today, one of the ladies got up and yanked it off. I thought, my God, Lorraine Bobbitt has joined Al-Anon. You didn't miss much. Isn't that microphone working over there? I'll do a little filler then. You may have noticed that if you were close enough that I have on, in addition to a dress suit, a sport jacket and so on, I have on a big pair of mountain boots. And if you think that looks odd, you should see my wife. She has on a dress and a big pair of mountain boots. That's because Bob arranged a... He said, there's a speaker's parking place reserved for us. It's in a snowdrift about half a mile down the road. I didn't get a chance to make all of the meetings, so I won't be able to insult everybody. We were going to... Paul, you know, we made reservations over at the Awani Hotel at 6 o'clock to make sure we would get over here in time. And they were still serving courses at 8 o'clock. I'm sorry about that. It was just what the doctor ordered. And I've been using Francine as a foil all day long. I don't know how many of you heard her Friday night, but if you didn't, you missed a most excellent talk. She cried repeatedly, and she was awaiting the results of the bar exam, and she's still crying. You know, it's odd. Depends how one views it. To my mind, to fail the bar exam is like getting a negative result on your Wasserman test. You know, it never seems to occur to us sometimes that conceivably we're being lovingly protected. She mentioned what her first profession was, and now she wants to become a lawyer. It hasn't changed a whole lot, really. I was reading in the Legal Journal the other day that, I don't know, almost two-thirds of the lawyers, when asked, said that they would not go into that profession again if they had a choice. And that wasn't the frightening part. The frightening part was there was about 30% of them said they liked what they did. That really set me back. This is a very enthusiastic group. I mean, your greeting, I haven't heard anything like that since the Pacific Group. You know, you give your name. My name is Don. Have I done that, by the way?
No.
Oh, let's do it then. My name is Don Gates, an alcoholic. You see, I don't know if you've ever been to Clancy's Pacific Group, but they have that staccato response. You know, it's terrifying, really. They used to do the same thing in Germany in 1936. Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil! But the reason I have on these boots, you know, I have a higher power who always gives me more than I need. And we had a note that it was apt to be cool and rainy up here. And my wife said, you know, it'd be nice if it snowed a little. So I put in a few words, and You know, as the cliche has it, there are more tears shed as a result of prayers that are answered than those that are not, Francine. Now, she really gave a truly excellent talk. The part, I guess, that I liked, and a number of people have mentioned it, you know, no smoking in here now, and I know that's tough for the one or two people who still smoke. But she was talking about how she learned to smoke because of the way it was shown in the movies. You know, and that's the same way it was with me. I used to do a shtick on that about how it is difficult for the non-alcoholic world to quite understand this, because only one person in 10 who drinks is going to have the good fortune to become alcoholic, or is alcoholic to start with. And whereas 10 out of 10 people who smoke for more than a few weeks are going to become hooked, and so they don't see the problem, and they don't ask smokers the kind of silly questions they ask us. You know, I never, maybe some of you here who still smoke, has anyone ever come up to you and said, "Why did you start smoking, Bill? Was it lack of self-esteem? Failure to close an Oedipus triangle? Are you the adult child of a smoking parent?" I mean, they don't ask those idiotic questions because they know why we started smoking. When you're into the testosterone rush as a male, about 14 or 15, by gosh, you want to look like a man. You want to do things that men do. Smoke. Now, the fact that when you're driving by a junior high school and you see some kids smoking, you know, they don't look very manly, or you're a punk, but if anyone wonders why I started smoking, watch some of those movies that were made in the 30s and 40s. Everybody smoked. Absolutely everybody. And Paul Henreid, he lit two at once, gave one to a lady, and got laid just like that. Betty Davis, in fact. Why did I start smoking? And in addition, in all the years that I smoked, I never had anybody come up to me and say, "My goodness, Don, you're already smoking. It's only 10 o'clock. Do you smoke as soon as you get up in the morning? You take a morning smoke? You smoke when you're alone?" You know, they just don't ask those questions because they understand. 10 people who smoke for any length of time become hooked. You're going to smoke about every 15 minutes till you die or quit, whichever comes first. And so they don't ask those dumb questions. I look back on it now. I had to quit smoking a little while back. I got a mantra to repeat, emphysema. And when you do quit something, you look back on it and it's almost impossible to understand it. You know, I come from the backwoods of Oregon, where we shoot the deer and hang the venison in the smoke shed behind the farm. I know what smoke does to raw meat, but for 35 years I made lung jerky. You know, I can't believe it. That countdown, I know there were a couple of people here who had only a couple of days and were brought up here to be humiliated, and I want to assure them, however, that this is probably going to be the highlight of their AA career, because here you work up to being ignored. I always have a difficult time with countdowns because I forget how long I've been sober. When I was new, I used to count my years. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. You know, and that's true. Just as a matter of curiosity, how many have the hands of people who are born after 1955? Okay, thank you. Yeah, thank you. See, that's one of the problems of communication. That was when I gave my first AA talk. in 1955, and now I am what is called, I'm among the chronologically challenged now. When you finally decide to quit drinking, then you pay little attention to your number of years of sobriety, because that just indicates how old you're getting. And but when I think about it, a good meeting going on out there, too. A young lady one time asked me how old I was sober, and I mentioned it, and she said, "Oh, what I wouldn't give to have even 25 years of sobriety." I said, "Do you realize how old you're going to be when you have 25 years of sobriety?" You know, she did a bit of mathematics and blanched, absolutely pale. She hadn't realized it was such an age. I didn't dare tell her that I made my first contact with AA in 1946. Can you imagine how old I would be now if I'd have stayed sober from that time on? The difficulty with doing more speaking than is good for mortal is that wherever you go, you have people come up who've heard you somewhere or other, and or they've listened to your tapes, and they ask, they never remember the spiritual insight that you give, the glittering jewels on which you can build a life. Now, all they remember are stories where you made a boob of yourself or something. And so I had a number of requests that I was going to... Before I get into it, though, the one thing I was talking to both our Al-Anon and our Francine speaker about being nervous. You know, they both indicated they were very nervous, you know, couldn't eat before talking and so on. And asking me if I was nervous, and I said, no, not anymore. When you analyze it, it is silly. You're speaking to a group of people who are, like you, are lucky to be out of an institution. You know, and we're concerned. I mean, what happens if I really go over big here? Maybe I'll get to take a meeting in Tobaccoville or something like that. But I used to be extremely nervous. When I spoke, my hands just trembled. And it wasn't because I didn't know that that was how I earned my living. But I knew I was relatively glib and could do things like that, but whenever I had to get up in front of a group, it would just, I had to learn to speak without notes, because if I held notes in my hand, it looked like a butterfly on a mating flight, you know. And I was a trial attorney, and that's a handicap. You know, you walk up to a witness and say, perhaps this will refresh your memory. And relieving that condition was one of the first things that was one of the first benefits I had in AA. I was driving down to speak at a prison along with another man who was in there, and he asked me to go with him to speak in his prison. And I was telling him about this condition of mine, this trembling whenever I had to address a group of people. And I ended my lament by saying, I guess it's just insecurity. Now, I didn't want an answer to this. This was my red badge of courage. I wanted him to slap me on the back and say, stout fellow, it is brave of you to carry on with such a fearsome malady. But he didn't say a word. He just sat there in total silence for an interminable period. Oh, probably not more than 30 seconds, but that's a long time when you're waiting for a compliment. And then he said, well, I guess you could call it insecurity if you want, but I suggest you flip the coin over, and on the other side, I warrant you'll find your big fat ego. We're driving down to a prison to speak to a bunch of men who are caged like animals because of a problem you think you found some kind of an answer to. Now, the reason you're going to be nervous is you don't give a goddamn about them. All you're thinking about is, what are they going to think of me? He said, if you get up there and speak, and they all are convinced that you're a glittering, silver-tongued orator, but you don't say a word that helps a man, you failed. What a thing to say to a sensitive newcomer. I took this like I take all constructive criticism, like a knife right in the back. That's how I took it. You know, I yanked out the blade. I tried to find some chink in his armor that I could thrust it in. And I didn't see any, so I returned it to my back and rotated like a pig on a spit for a little while. And then I thought, you know, by golly, he's right. That's why I'm nervous. I'm not thinking about what I can say to help them. I don't get nervous talking to somebody in my front room. I'm not thinking about them. And so before I got up to speak that night, I kind of lowered my head and said, anybody up there listening, let me think about helping somebody else and not think about myself for once. I got up there, and for the first time in my entire life, steady as a rock. Next time I had to go into a courtroom, I kind of slipped into a phone booth. did a semi-genuflection and said, okay, whoever it was, I'm going here now. Why don't you let me go in and this time just say what I can as honestly as I can for my client and not be concerned with the judge and the bailiff and the jury and the people in the audience think of me. I went in there and by gosh, same thing. Steady as a rock. And it hasn't ever bothered me again, except on one or two occasions, not in AA, where I had to give a talk that I wanted to impress people with. You know, I wanted to show them something so that they would recognize what a sterling chap hides behind this humble facade. And right away it would start. Another one somebody asked me for, I think the committee said something about not paying our way if I didn't tell it. It's a story that I guess has become sort of a thing people recognize in my monologues, and I will do it because it was a breakthrough in my life. Up until the event that I'm going to describe, I had always been able to explain any problem I got into, any social conflict I incurred while drinking, on someone else. Because it's virtually impossible to come into conflict with society without some member contributing to the scene. And therefore, you can blame it on him. In other words, if he hadn't have made a left turn, I wouldn't have hit him. See, which is true, but if I hadn't been an unguided missile coming down the street, he might have noticed I might have noticed his left turn considerably earlier. Nor if he hadn't said what he said about our beloved president, I wouldn't have a broken nose. You know, which again is true, but if I had not been bombed, he might not have made his point quite so tellingly. But on this particular occasion that I'll relate, it was a breakthrough for me. You see, I drank almost exclusively to relax. And on this particular occasion, I'd been relaxed about a week. And I awoke from a fearful, frightening, nightmarish dream. It was Dante's Inferno. There were imps of the perverse. I could smell the brimstone. And it was a horrible scene. And I staggered to my feet, you know, trying to regain my senses. I found I was actually drenched with perspiration. And I thought, what's wrong? You know, it fleetingly occur to me alcohol might have something to do with it. But then I noticed that such wasn't the case, because I saw that I had passed out, I had retired. I had nodded off on a couch, apparently, because from it there was emanating a thin spire of smoke. Well, I knew then what had happened. I'd had either a cigarette in my fingers or mouth, and it had fallen, when I nodded off, onto the couch and burnt through that covering, that kind of plastic covering, down into the matting, where, lacking oxygen enough to take fire, the embers had simply spread over the course of the night. And I knew there was nothing wrong with my drinking. I'd just been barbecued. I don't know where my family was, wherever they used to go at night, but But seeing it, I felt very relieved at my perspicacity, and I went into the kitchen, I got a pitcher of water, came back and tried to pour it into that little hole, succeeding only in producing a rather spectacular cascade on the carpet. And I realized then more dramatic measures were needed, so I went into the kitchen, came back with a butcher knife, slashed the couch open from one side to the other, opened it up, and then subdued the embers with the cooling balm of the water. The only thing is that it produced acrid black smoke. Now, this has been 50 years ago, half a century, a quarter of this nation's history. And I can remember standing there, looking down at that slashed and sodden mass, and knowing almost to a certainty that my wife was going to notice it. She was a very keen-eyed woman, and there was little that passed her ken around the house, I'll tell you. And though she was a good woman, didn't know about Al-Anon, but like Carol, she would never say anything intentionally to assail the manhood of the head of the household, to attack his masculinity. But there were moments of stress in which she had been known to say things that were unkind, cruel things even, things that when she thought of them later would cause her great remorse. And naturally, I wanted to spare her this. The only thing I could think of was to get the couch out of the house. You know, I mean, she might vaguely remember there had been something on that side of the room, but out of sight, out of mind. The only thing is that it really isn't easy to be moving a bed couch when you should be checking into a sanitarium. But with that Herculean strength that comes only to the panic-stricken and youthful alcoholic, I somehow managed to heft that brute up onto my shoulder and stagger out the front door. At that time, we were living on the second floor of an apartment complex that had a very small little porch. It had columns. I remember I virtually beat myself to death trying to make the turn, caroming off the post, you know, bung, bung, bung. But ultimately I succeeded, and when I reached the bottom of the stairs, I saw that, like Bobby Burns's mouse, foresight had not been my long suit. There is virtually no place to conceal a couch in a typical apartment patio. And suddenly, you know, I'm standing there. I should be in a hospital, but I'm moving furniture. And I remember a creek about 5 miles away. So I lurched to my car, and I hefted that brute up on top of it, and got in to drive to my selected place of repose. Now, all I have ever really wanted in life was dignity. I have not caviled at disaster when I can face it with dignity. But by this time, as I was driving down the street, it had become daylight. You know, I don't know what time it was, 6:30, 7:30, you know, there were people at the bus stops anyhow with lunch pails and briefcases and things, and I have no idea how they can stay up that late, but you watch that. But as I drove down the street, I noticed that all of their heads turned to follow my progress. Eyes wide, jaws agape. I thought, by golly, it doesn't take much to draw a crowd in California. I'll say that. until I passed by an auto dealership that had a very dusty window in their display case that acted like a mirror, and I got a glimpse of what it was they were looking at. Here comes a fella down the street with a week's growth of beard, nattily attired in a bathrobe. And on top of his car rests a couch, which previously had lacked oxygen enough to take flame. But going down the street, the wind was going through it like a billows, and the flames were 30, 40 feet in the air. Vroom, vroom. I finally did return to the house. I could find no way of blaming my sleeping wife and children for having imperiled their lives, as they obviously had. And so it did indeed begin to occur to me that there might be some problem I was having with drink. But that's enough of that. Just suffice it to say that subsequently I was to move beyond social drinking. In fact, I wasn't getting into any trouble at the end of my drinking. How much trouble can you get into in a hotel room with a bottle of wine and a copy of Playboy? Oh, look at that poor misshapen creature. Send Esmeralda to me before you ring the bells. The thing is that today I don't go in much for drunkologues, as many of you may know who suffered through some of my monologues, because it doesn't tell you what I used to be like. You know, people get up and under the guise of telling what they were like, they give you a drunkologue of the things that happened to them, almost suggesting they did it on purpose. I've even heard them say, I can't blame the things that I did whilst drinking on the flit. And I always think, oh, you poor soul, that must be tragic. I can. You know, I blame virtually every rotten thing that happened to me on the fact I was drunk. You know, hell, I never even planned to be an alcoholic. I never walked into some counselor's office and said, I think I'd like to major in vomiting. Perhaps a minor in diarrhea. I never planned an evening the way it went. Never. I never said to myself, well, let's see, what'll we do? It's Friday night. I got a pint in the house. I think I'll kill that, then I'll go out and total the car. I've just canceled the insurance to save money, so that'll be a good start. Perhaps on the way to the hospital, the ambulance attendant will roll me and I'll have no identification. I can spend 24 hours being humiliated down at General, but I'll get out on Sunday, and I can cuff another jug on the way home, and I can terrorize the wife and children all day Sunday afternoon. I'm sure from the moment I arose tonight, you noticed that I was far too sophisticated, urbane, and gentle a soul to do things like that, but they happened to me. See, because if you're an alcoholic of the type that I was, you're a slave to the darn stuff. You know, it decides what you're going to do. It's like Aladdin in reverse. I mean, you uncork the bottle and out comes a genie, except instead of you telling it what you're going to do, it tells you what you're going to do. And I don't think I ever really did anything until I got on the program. And therefore, to me, this AA, though it doesn't seem so to the newcomer, has been a real birth of freedom. I mean, it's like Martin Luther King's favorite old hymn there about free at last, great God Almighty, free at last. See, because now we can do anything we want. You know, it's like some God set forth a feast of experience, sensual, emotional, intellectual, and said, take what you want of this banquet and then pay for it. See, that way, you find out whether you want to repeat it or not. See, because it is quite possible when you're drinking to continue the same mistake for years and years, because you don't learn. As soon as you begin taking alcohol or some of the better living through chemistry that's available today, you stop the learning process, because we learn through the pain-pleasure principle. You do something wrong and you're punished. It's how you train dogs, it's how you train children, it's how you train old men. Do something good and they're rewarded. See, but when you take a shot of something, that hoo-wee, and you get the reward that you don't earn. And that doesn't work right. And when you do something absurd, something shameful, for which you wake up in the horror the next day, you don't pay the price because you take some more of that hoo-wee and it goes away. You know, and I always woke up with something wrong. I mean, I don't think I ever came out of a blackout on a drunk and said to myself, gosh, you were great last night. Mother Teresa would have been proud. I don't know that there, of course, is any way to short-circuit that. You have to keep at it until you get into that state of sweet reasonableness known only to the dying. That seems to be a prerequisite to the thought that you might be wrong. And we're just like the non-alcoholic. We're not going to give up a lifetime of failure without a struggle. In fact, sometimes the non-alcoholic will say of us, you know, you alkies, you're lacking in willpower. Do you know why they say that? They think we wanted to stay sober. Yeah. If they had but understood what our true goal was, they would stand in awe of our dedication and perseverance. I mean, what do they have they will pursue to the gates of insanity or death? Nothing. I mean, they're candy asses, all of them. I don't mean that, Carol. You're not at fault. You just seem to have been born that way. No, I mean, we have incredible willpower. It usually takes the form of won't power, but it's there. I mean, most of us wouldn't cross the street if we thought it would make us feel better. Well, stay right here and hurt. I can take it as long as you can, you bitch. I won't change. I don't dare hurt you. Because in order to stay sober, which is very simple, by the way. In fact, I was speaking down in Texas one time, you know, and among the cliches that they have on the walls, they had one down there that said, if you want to quit drinking, you're going to have to quit drinking. And I thought, that is the dumbest thing I have ever seen in a state where stupidity is the national motto. But the more I reflected on it, I thought, my God, the sovereign state of Texas once again has caught the kernel of truth that lies in this program. That really is the answer to AA. If you want to quit drinking, by God, you're going to have to quit drinking. Thank you. I mean, really, that's it. I mean, all of the other things, of course, are helpful. But if you want, it is amazing how long you can stay sober if you don't drink. That's why I mentioned my stuttering sobriety. You know, I would come on and they would tell me when I would fall off again. Every good scientist tests a hypothesis, I think, at least once or twice. In fact, I believe if people came to their first AA meeting and let go of the bottle permanently, couldn't have had much of a grip on it. But that's a slipper's lament. But they used to tell me, Don, what you've got to do if you want to make this program is get into your inventory. And so I would take plume and paper and sit down and, you know, and go up my stream of consciousness looking for character defects. Still have trouble. And they would say, well, what you've got to do is work with the newcomers. And I'd drag them off the bar stools, ready or not, you know, and I would still have trouble. And they'd say, well, you've got to find a higher power. And I would pursue God up and down the byways of the San Fernando Valley, and I'd still have trouble. And as I mentioned 31 years ago next month, I decided to quit drinking. Haven't had any trouble since. That's a strange thing. The reason, by the way, I mentioned that bit about the speaking is that I was trying to convince Francine of that you shouldn't confuse glibness with sincerity. See, I was the main speaker at my second AA meeting. And as a result, I never got to raise my hand as a newcomer because I thought it, you know, might hurt the newcomer. I attended my first meeting in Beverly Hills. There's a men's stag there on Wednesday nights. And I had gotten there and I was looking for work. And I had called this law office and the fellow said he would meet me. And he suggested I meet him in Roxbury Park at 8:30 at night. I thought, that's kind of a strange place to get together for a business meeting, but I'd heard about Hollywood. And so I went there, and it was an AA meeting. If any of you have been there, it's the men's stag meeting where they point the finger for five-minute pitches. Now, this was almost 40 years ago. And they were the wittiest bunch of people I'd ever seen. I wasn't in bad shape. I mean, it's a Wednesday night. I'd been drunk all week, you know, but I'd kind of tapered off on Monday and think I even had some chili on Tuesday. You know, and so by Wednesday, I wasn't shaking and trembling. I was very quick, but but I wasn't in bad shape. And these were the wittiest, most intelligent, likable bunch of guys I had seen in years. I mean, Chuck Chamberlain was there. He had 4 or 5 years. Jack Bailey, the Queen for a Day fella, had a couple of years. I mean, these people were witty and clever and funny, and I was just delighted with it. And at the end of the meeting, the leader looked around and said, well, let's see, who will we get to close it? How about the young fellow sitting up front with the shiny black hair? See, that was your humble servant 40 years ago. And he said, would you like to close it for us? And I said, certainly, I'd be glad to. I mean, I've been a member of AA now for almost an hour and a half. And I'm a very quick study. You throw me into any particular environment and chameleon-like, I take on the coloration. You throw me in jail, I look around, I see hard as the shtick here. But I'll screw. I mean, afraid somebody's going to put the arm on me, but I'd been in AA now long enough, I could see humility was the gig. Hell, I can out-humble any clown in a house when I put my mind to it. So I got up and I gave him a couple of minutes of pathos, a couple of minutes of laughter, ended on a rising note of hope, and sat down, and they flocked around me to touch the hem of my garment. And one fellow said, you haven't spoken out at the Arroyo Seco meeting recently, have you? Well, I just drunk my way down to Los Angeles from San Francisco with a brief stopover for some undergraduate work in Camarillo, and I had no idea what the Arroyo Seco was, so I was reasonably sure I hadn't spoken there. And he said, well, I'm leading the meeting next whatever night it was, a few nights hence. He said, I'd like you to be my main speaker. Would you do it? I said, certainly. Always glad to help the poor devil crushed by the juggernaut demon rum. For 50 minutes, I gave him a little more pathos, a little more laughter, ended on a rising note of hope, you know, and sat down. And if you can get two people to laugh in any talk, you get two invitations for each pitch you made. So within a couple of months, my whole schedule, I was booked up every night. Now, I hadn't read the book, I hadn't taken the steps, I didn't know anything about being a sponsor. I was staying sober on the novelty of applause and a solid bowel movement. But if you don't get into the secondary part of the program, which is really the program, you're going to get taken drunk. See, because the program is laid out in a chapter with a subtle caption, how it works. And now that'll escape the intellectual. I mean, anything that simple can't possibly be an answer. I mean, if it were entitled the Psychodynamics of Permanent Aridity or something, you might But you see, alcoholism today, when I first came around, it seemed to me the most mysterious malady for which science not only had no cure, didn't even have an adequate definition. And now it seems to me the simplest disorder ever to have afflicted mankind, the most easily recognizable, identifiable, and treatable. The very name, alcoholism, gives you such a marked clue as to what the problem is. That if you weren't handicapped with a degree in psychology, and someone were to say to you, what do you think causes alcoholism? I warrant you'd come up with the correct response instantly. Alcohol? I mean, that's it. If alcohol had not been invented, there would not be one person on the face of the earth classified, identified as an alcoholic. We don't have any different emotional grasp than the non-alcoholic. Our book says the only thing that characterizes us, distinguishes us from the non-alcoholic, is the phenomenon of craving that results from taking the first drink. I mean, that's it. I've never known an alcoholic to suffer from a single emotional problem that non-alcoholics don't suffer from. I mean, occasionally, well, you hear speakers get up and say, I didn't have a drinking problem, I had a living problem. Now, you know what they mean, but the implication seems to be that non-alcoholics have dead problems. I mean, we have exactly the same problems that non-alcoholics do. But you have to be a little careful there, because many speakers get up, they can't talk about alcoholism because all you can say is, I got it, you know, and that's it. So they get up, and under the guise of talking about alcoholism, they describe their own particular hang-ups. And if you're not careful, you may be mistaken into thinking that that is alcoholism. In fact, they may even, by that quaintness that'll make you vomit up your sleeve today, they call it the ism, which is, I shudder at the thought. But we had a guy, I remember when I first came around, he used to look out over the audience and say, the first thing you're going to have to recognize and admit if you want to make this program is that you're a thief. Because all alcoholics are thieves. Well, this really shook me, because I did not steal material things. Maybe I didn't need it badly enough. Maybe I was too frightened. I don't know. I mean, I stole everything worthwhile, your time, your love, your affection, your kindness, your patience, your forgiveness. But I never didn't steal physical things. But it disturbed me to hear the guy say this. And then I thought, just a minute now. He doesn't know all alcoholics. Even if he had a wide range of friendship, he couldn't know more than a few hundred. So what he says about all alcoholics tells you absolutely nothing about all alcoholics, but it tells you something about him. He said, all alcoholics are thieves. I'm an alcoholic. Ergo, he's a thief. And he was. I watched him burn newcomers for years. I mean, it didn't hurt him any, but that was his particular hang-up. I never lent him any money. We got along well. We had another guy who was even more disconcerting. He used to actually point his finger around the room and say, if you want this program, the first thing you're going to have to concede is that you're a latent homosexual. Now, this really disturbed me, see? I mean, I'm trying to quit drinking, and he's telling me I got to give up boys. I mean, hell, I'd never tried them, and as far as I knew, they might be the answer. My wife sure as hell wasn't... And then I realized, once again, he doesn't know all alcoholics, but I've learned something interesting about him. So alcoholism is caused by drinking alcohol. Without it, you don't have any problem with alcohol. And you know, it's so simple. Occasionally a newcomer will say, question and answer meeting, raise a shaky hand, say, how do you really quit drinking? You know, as if there was some magic to it. There's nothing mysterious about it. All you have to do is control the movement of your elbow. Nobody's going to put it in your mouth for you. Now, you may be too spastic-like when you get here that your arm reaches out and hurls substances toward your face. But if you can fend it off, eternal sobriety is yours. There's no magic. I mean, there's going to be no evangelist like Oral or his brother Anal who's going to say, heal, heal, out thou demon rum. Or no fairy is going to touch you with a magic wand, which happened to me in West Hollywood one night. No, I mean, it was a wonderful experience, but it didn't help me with my drinking. No, the solution to it is the one they had in Texas. If you want to quit drinking, then by God, you're going to have to quit drinking. And that's all there is to it. The only thing is that in order to do that, you have to deal with a secondary part of our disease, the thing that makes us necessary to gather in rooms like this. And that's the obsession. That somehow, you know, by the way, it has nothing to do with insanity. When it says being restored to insanity, they're not talking about either the legal or the medical definition of it, because the book tells us exactly when we know we'll be restored to sanity. It says you will know it because then you will recoil from the first drink as from a flame. I mean, that's all they're talking about. The obsession is defined. What is the great obsession of the abnormal drinker? The persistence of the illusion that somehow, someday, is going to control and enjoy his drinking. And in order to keep our barometer below that spell of storm that'll set us off again with the obsession, we have to learn to live a way of life that is quite contented. You know, every saint, sage, elder of the village who has ever reflected upon how one should live has been absolutely unanimous in their recommendations. There's nothing unique in AA that I have found. I've read books written 2,000 years ago that were direct plagiarisms from our big book. I mean, honesty as a way of life is not exactly unique insight by AA. Down at Chino Prison in the Iron Scroll Works over one of the gates, it says, "The truth shall set ye free." When I've spoken there, I've always pointed out that means ultimately, not immediately. The idea of inventory and confession doesn't come as a shock to the Pope. You know, we say here that AA is a spiritual program, not a religious one. Now, we know what we mean by that. We mean we have no ideology, no dogma, no particular credos that anyone must adhere to. But sometimes we say it in a way as to imply that religions are not spiritual, which comes as a shock to those movements that have been getting along for millennia while we were still sucking on jugs, you know, and unable to explain to them. This program is so simple. It's read like the Chinese water torture at virtually every meeting, how it works. They even have the steps numbered so the intellectual know the sequence. You know, I didn't even hear it for a while. And when I finally did, I couldn't believe it. Because I've read various disciplines. I've never read any that was less appealing, less intellectually satisfying than Alcoholics Anonymous. About the only thing Alcoholics Anonymous has going for it and the others don't is that it works. But beyond that, nothing. I mean, you come in and the very first step says that you admitted you were powerless over alcohol. It doesn't say you admitted you're an alcoholic. I recognized that years before I came to AA. That explained why I drank the way I did. But I wasn't powerless. I'd come out of a courtroom, the other attorney might say, "Well, we had a tough day, you know, why don't we stop and have a couple of beers?" And I'd say, "Well, let's see, I can't. Today is Tuesday. I have to be back in court on Thursday." They look at you a little strangely, but if you can decide when you're going to start and when you're going to stop, you're not powerless over alcohol. A powerlessness was not in my lexicon. I had been taught all of my life, when the going gets tough, the tough get going, but first you don't succeed, try again, never say quit. And admit to powerlessness, that you're like some leaf that could be caught by a passing wind, twisted, turned, deposited where the wind would, I mean, that is a frightful concession. I just could not conceive of it. The second and third steps I readily understood. They were talking about God. I come from the backwoods of Oregon, where you're either a Pentecost or an atheist. There's no half measures about it. Seeing you are but lukewarm, the Lord God Jehovah shall spew you out of his mouth. It was hard for me. In fact, one of my uncles one time, somebody asked him, "Do you believe in infant baptism?" He said, "Believe in it? Hell, I've seen it done." Uh, They were asking me in that second and third step to step off into a void, to be supported by something I knew to be non-existent. I had read the Bible, not looking for solace or insight or strength, but in order to have material with which to flagellate the Christians in those barroom discussions. Finally, I gave it up. I mean, there's no point in it. Nobody else reads it. You don't have to read it. You just make it up as you go along. Walk into a bar room, sit down beside some damsel and say, "Blessed is she who welcomed the stranger unto her bed." Leviticus 9:17. I mean, what the hell does she know, Leviticus 9:17? But you already have kind of a spiritual leg up, as it were. And now the fourth and fifth steps, that I could understand. I mean, the fourth step, it says you sit down with pencil and paper, or pen and paper, or computer nowadays, and you write a list of your sins, crimes, felonies, acts of disloyalty, and breaches of trust. That's the first thing they tell you in law school, don't ever do, or don't ever allow a client to do. That isn't the way to avoid problems, that's the way to ensure them. But surely, if you did it, you might get some kind of a pattern of your life. But then, what would you do if you had any brains whatsoever? You would take them and burn those shameful sheets, stomp the ashes into the dust. AA says, no, you immediately run to some blabbermouth, laying yourself open to a lifetime of sure blackmail. I mean, the judiciary stays up at night trying to prevent people from taking fifth steps. You can't make a confession, which is admissible today, unless it's made in the presence of four lawyers and three nuns. Then if you did it, you move along through the steps, and you get to the amend step. It says, having done this ridiculous thing, you then have a list of people to whom you can make amends. Isn't that something? After all they've done to us, we're supposed to make amends to them. I mean, they've smitten us the 99 blows, and if we retaliated once, we're supposed to go apologize. You know, when I first got here, I couldn't even think of a person to make an amend to. And it troubled me. I thought, you're not perfect, are you? It didn't seem probable, yet all the evidence pointed in that direction. Finally, I thought of one guy, and I sat down and I wrote him a letter. It said, "Dear sir, I've joined an organization which is part of its discipline, requires that if any way I've hurt or offended another human being, I should apologize. I therefore wish to say that I'm sorry I shot you. If I can be of further service to you in the future, however, please do not hesitate to call upon me." You know, that's been decades ago. The guy hasn't even answered. Terrible the way they carry a grudge out there. But if you do those things, finally you get to step 12, which, as I read it, said I would now be entitled to get up at 3 in the morning to call on somebody who was going to puke on my shoes. I thought, boy, there's a soft sell. I mean, the more I drank, the more helpless I became, the more I hated drunkenness and helplessness in others. Now I'm going to dedicate my life to it? I mean, that does not appeal. I remember going on further into the book, I thought maybe in that vision for you, I'll find something a little more palatable. Visions often have a kind of a friendly overtone. And there it says, if you will do these things, which they're characterized rather quaintly as putting your house in order, it said, surely you will meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. I thought, trudge. Of all of the verbs in the English language that describe locomotion, they pick trudge. I mean, when I was younger, I have had people say to me, "You come with me, fella. I'm a swinger. I never had anybody say, 'You come with me. I'm a trudger.' You know, that's Rudyard Kipling. Boots, marching up and down again. Put slogging over Africa.
there's no end to the war.
The program does not appeal to the intellect. But there is a solution to that, and that is to keep drinking. AA is a great, alcohol itself is a great proselytizer for AA. It isn't the speakers, though some of them are extraordinarily eloquent and gifted, and it isn't our book, though it is right straightforward without a bunch of Greek mythological nonsense. What really gets the intellectual, perhaps through friction against the gutter that'll wear off the point on his head, is alcohol. I can remember lying in those hotel rooms, unable to move, and thinking, God, down at the meetings, they're trudging. Oh, boogie, boogie. When you're immobile, that sounds very enticing. So you try the steps, and they work. As I said, not because they're unique. They are, in essence, a summation of all of the spiritual movement that every saint, sage, elder of the village ever reflected on. The only thing is, they don't have to do it. The various religious groups, they can define it, they can debate it, they can fight about it, they can kill each other over it, they can do everything they want except work it. We have to work it. We don't want to. God knows no newcomer ever came in looking for joy or pleasure, but you can get used to it. It isn't that bad. Contentment can even be born in time. It has its price, of course. You won't be able to be hip and slick and cool anymore. I mean, you won't be able to say, what's happening, man? I mean, shit, you'll know. I'm sorry about that scatological term. You can strike that, Mr. Reporter. But no, we have to do it, and they don't, because nothing ever happens to them. They live lives of quiet desperation, clinging to those dubious luxuries of resentment and self-pity and getting even and paying back, looking out for number one. You know, I watch them downtown where I work, their knuckles white, their jaws tense. Going to get that bitch on the stand, make her admit she's an unfit mother right in front of the children. I don't want justice, I want blood. Ito the other day was talking about issuing a gag order in the Simpson case, and I told him, don't bother, all I have to do is hear about it and I gag. I don't even need an order. You see, because nothing happens significant to them. No one has ever been arrested for driving while pissed off. You don't get booked for being a common mope, whining and disorderly. We have to do it. The great scourge, the great lash for us is alcohol. It makes me do the things that are necessary to put up with a life of happiness. I was just going to reach your problem. I wish you hadn't left. Life has been so good for me, but I don't want the newcomer to lose all hope. There are going to be moments during your sobriety that will curl your hair. Things are going to happen to you more tragic than anything you can possibly imagine. Because the world that is the old world yet, the world does not rise up on its tippy toes in order to avoid upsetting my tender psyche. All of the things that flesh are heir to are going to happen to us. People who love you are going to abandon you. You're not going to be appreciated where you should be. People that you dearly love are going to die. You're going to grow sick. I mean, all of the things. My wife came home about 4 or 5 years ago, interrupted a burglar. He smashed her in the face, broke all the bones in her face, took 2 plastic surgeries to put her together. He wasn't there to get me, as the police thought. He was just some guy loaded on crack. He happened to pick our house. Now, she has 27 years of sobriety. You might say, well, how could that happen to someone who's devoted their life, the bulk of it, to trying to help people with drug and alcohol problems? The thing is, why not? Why shouldn't it happen to us? The rain falls on the just and the unjust alike. Nothing personal about it. In fact, conceivably, we'll be in a better position maybe to even understand it than the non-alcoholic. Because he's going to come on the program someday, I hope. And he'll have a very funny story. I mean, we tell, you know, our stories, the non-alcoholic doesn't see quite the way we do. You know, I have asked my friends in the industry, why do you show AA as those gloomy, desperate meetings? Why don't you show it the way it is? Remember those horrible scenes where Burt Lancaster got his first birthday cake and come back little Sheba? Oh, hang on. You know. Or Jack Lemmon, you know, in the days of Wine and Roses when Jack was still pretending to be an alcoholic. And if the meetings were like the ones that Jack was going to, I'd have gone out and got drunk with his wife. And I say, why don't you show it the way it is? And they say, we can't do it. How can you possibly show a room filled with people with a terminal illness and someone gets up and tells a story that would tear tears from the heart of a stone and they roll in the aisle with laughter? And then I got the Jake leg and couldn't walk. Then I drank canned heat and went blind. Now this guy, when he comes on, he'll have a funny story. He'll say, yeah, you know what, I just happened to pick out a house in the San Fernando Valley. I needed a fix, you know, I picked up, my luck, you know, and I got a judge. Not only a judge, but a justice of the appellate courts. And when his wife came in, pop, I put her in a hospital. I don't know if I'll laugh, but I'm not going to sponsor him. Less than a year after that, in a small town north of L.A., someone burglarized the house of my 80-year-old stepmother, raped her, grabbed her by the face, ruined her Cadillac surgery. Less than a year after that, somebody in an even smaller town where everybody looked out for her, burglarized the home of my mother and murdered her. This is a tragic world we live in. Sorrow is here. I don't want to add 1 ounce to it by racking revenge or getting even, doing anything. I mean, the accumulation is so great. But these things are going to happen. Sometimes it's going to seem like you're standing in a cylinder of pain in which there's not only no door, there isn't even a seam. And you forfeited your right to chemical peace of mind, and you just stand there and hurt. And then one day it falls away and you see the world like you never saw it before. Nothing ever quite bothers you anymore. Everything that I have done on this program has been an adventure. When I first got here, I thought, like most newcomers, oh, no more bright lights, no more Friday night parties, just a walk through a dark, dank tunnel, or up some arid mount carrying my cross of sobriety. And it hasn't been like that at all. I have actually gotten out, and to the best of my knowledge, I have done everything sober that I ever have fantasized about. And I've got a weird thought process at times that I never did drinking. I think the thing I despise most about my drinking years is not so much the horrible things I did. I mean, I regret them. But if you're powerless over alcohol, then you don't really regret it too much, or you're acting as if you could have done otherwise. I mean, I'm sorry I hurt other people, but the thing I hate most is the weeks, the months, the years I lost drunk, on the nod, sullen, sodden drunkenness. Or sometimes I would get so bad they'd have to hospitalize me. And sometimes I would do something so antisocial they'd throw me in jail and rub my nose in it. You know, and even when I wasn't actually drunk, I was building up resentment to justify the next go-around. And I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to do any of that. And I recommend, I know, of course, I'm old, you young people regard yourself as immortal. Well, it's true, you know, I remember one of my sons going through the testosterone rush. You know, he said to me, you know, Dad, if I should ever die. I said, what do you mean, if, punk? Not a hypothesis, it's reality, I'm looking at it. That's true, by the way, I've given up the thought of suicide. How much time would I really save if you got right down to it? But I want everybody to get out if they possibly can and start living. Make the most of it. 50 years, everybody in this room is going to be dead, even the young ones. We rise like bubbles and champagne pop, we're gone. Wink of a celestial eye, and it's over, this miracle of awareness and life. You know, you've got to get out and do it. I used to talk about all of the things I have done that I thought of as living exuberant, ebullient life. I look back on it now and I see something a little bit different. It is that, but it's something more than that. I was watching one of those PBS shows on the brain a while back. Fascinating. And they were discovering that alcoholics, unlike non-alcoholics, do not produce endorphins. That's that endogenous morphine that the body gives when it is subject to stress and stimulation. We don't produce it like other people. Therefore, for us, though we have no different emotions, they're always more flaming. We're either way up or way down. You know, we don't have anything that deal with stress like the others. And there was a guy out in the valley many years ago, I think he ran an aircraft company, and he used to talk about, suppose you were born with a headache, a chronic, dull headache, not a drop-to-your-knees migraine, but just a dull, throbbing headache. If you had it from birth, how would you know other people didn't have it too? You'd have no way of knowing. You would assume everybody had it that way. And yet they would go about their life happy, laughing, getting ahead, doing things, and you wouldn't, because everything would be a struggle for you, and you never seem to quite be right. And then suppose someday when you were 14 or 15, someone gave you some aspirin, and the headache went away. What would you do? If you had the slightest degree above lunacy, what you would do is take aspirin at every possible opportunity. Not because you wanted to escape, be irresponsible, but in order that you could be like other people. But suppose the aspirin turned on you and you began to spend all kinds of money you shouldn't, doing wild and crazy things, hurting your family, hurting society. What would you do? You'd stop taking aspirin. And the moment you stopped, the headache would come back. I mean, that's the plight we're in. And when I describe the things that I used to do or have done since I've been on the program, I didn't realize what was actually happening. I described about the fact that I got through the male menopause racing motorcycles with Steve McQueen out in the desert. The only copy of the big book they used to see out around Barstow on Sunday. You know. I told the guy, he said, you know, your program seems more interesting than mine. What do you do different? I said, my program's no different. Have you learned how to fly? You know, and he said, no. I said, I did. I went out to an old anachronistic flight school in the San Fernando Valley, took 3 hours of training and soloed. Rented a plane that weekend, flew to San Francisco. It didn't have any instruments. I didn't know anything about navigation. I just flew over Highway 101. Ha, 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 down there. Work the stuff. Took my first free fall parachute jump just before I became a grandfather about 25 years or so ago. Took up scuba diving. I know you're supposed to study, put on flippers, snorkel, practice or something. I don't have time for that. I mean, you hum a couple of bars, I'll pick it up. Besides, when I came around, they said all the alcohol he needs to know is in the big book. So why in the hell would I bother with snorkels? I put all the gear on, leaped off Catalina Island, swam down on Seaweed City. It was so beautiful down there, I stayed down till I ran out of air. See, that's the nice thing about this program. You don't need chemical courage because you have the greatest scapegoat ever known to man. You have your higher power. Is that a newcomer? Actually, must be an orphan. A parent wouldn't let him stay in the room and make that noise. Yeah, but the oh God, yeah, I know. So young. I have some candy in the car, but they're a little young.
But you see, with your higher power, you can do anything you... I haven't made a mistake in decades. No errors, no deviations from the path of valor or rectitude have I been guilty of. Not even the faintest pawpaw. On the other hand, God has seen fit to do through me some of the dumbest, most egomaniacal, lewd, lurid, self-aggrandizing things that you can imagine. See, but if it gives him pleasure to make me look like a horse's ass, who are you to criticize? I mean, take it up with him. The other speakers come up here and they tell you what they tell you, what they have to say is their own opinion. That's not true with me. I've taken the third step. What I tell you is the word of God. And you better listen up. The only trouble is he keeps changing his message about once a month making me look like a boob for having misconstrued it in my last talk. See, but that's what it's all about. We've hiked in the Alps, we've gone down the length of Grand Canyon and the river, we've done all of these things, and it suddenly dawned on me when I watched this PBS show, every one of these things is a risk sport. Now, risk sports produce endorphins. Why do people ride on roller coasters? It's frightening. But when they get off, look at them. I mean, they're high. Well, there are various ways of getting high without getting drunk. The program will teach you how to do that. Make a 12-step call. God, you hate that. When you come away, you feel good. Anything that puts a stress on you. I had to quit smoking, you know, which is a simple thing. You get on your knees, you bark like a dog for a week, and... and my lungs were so bad, they said, get into running. I thought, running? I mean, I talked about despicable forms of locomotion earlier, trudging, but if there's anything worse than trudging, it's running. And all my life, I've seen old men with gnarled, knobby knees grunting and panting along the sides of highways, and I thought, oh, that it should come to that. Yeah, fanatic is anybody who's doing something a week before I start. Now I'm one of them. I couldn't go half a block when I started. You know, but I kept it up. I have a thing for pain, like most alcoholics. And I caught myself skipping as I went to my car to go to a meeting one night. And I thought, what the hell's wrong with you? I hope the neighbors didn't see that. You know, I mean, I haven't skipped since I was a boy. I don't know that I skipped as a boy. People have called me Mr. Gates since I was 13. You know, I all allow my intimates to call me sir. And I thought, what's wrong? Well, then I realized nothing was wrong. I had actually run 2 miles without stopping. And the days when we were more primitive and chased game, when you tired and did something exerting, the body kicked in with endorphins. I realized I was high. Well, you know what happened then. If 2 miles will get you high, how about 4, 8, 16? In moderation is a rumor to me. Within the year, I was running half marathon. I had stress fractures both feet, bursitis the hip, my back gave out. I didn't have a moment free from pain after I got healthy. I've run 5 marathons, 26 milers. You know, I don't recommend this sort of thing. The honest thing is that starting as late as I did in life and with the horrible lung condition I had, every race I was in, I won. Isn't that amazing? I don't mean I came in first. I have no idea what those fools up front are doing. But in the rear where the spiritual ones gather, they have categories by age, by sex, by profession. I have continued to refine my category till I'm the only one who's in it. So when I finish, I win. By the way, that's not as absurd as you think, because that is true of life. We're the only ones in our category. We're not competing with each other. You play the game, you bear the pain, you finish, you're a winner. Go out and get drunk again, you're a loser. I mean, it's relatively simple. I'm trying to find some rising note of hope to get the hell off here with. Well, let me just, I'll do it with this there. I was talking about the non-alcoholics not understanding. See, when I had a heck of a time, Francine, and she worried about getting a job, naturally, because she's in that odd state where you're too qualified for what you were doing. When I first hit L.A. 40 years ago now, I couldn't get a job at all because I was on probation for felonious assault. And just my last job, I'd been a chief trial deputy in a district attorney's office, and so I was slightly in an odd position. But I am of the Depression school where you have to work. And so I would go down and the shape-ups and the freight yards, and if they didn't have enough union men, they might pick me and I could push a handcart all day. And then I might go out and caddy. I don't know anything about golf, but I would have two big golf bags, you know, and one of those guys would say, "Hey, boy, how far to the green?" "Hey, boy, get your hands up against the wall. Spread your goddamn..." You know, but I finally got a job working for the Santa Fe Railroad as a mud hop. That meant I walked up and down between boxcars and wrote down the number and type of car it was. And I got everyone right. I mean, 9 years of college counts for something. And so I was advanced for a very short period of time. I was running the interchange between the Santa Fe and the Southern Pacific, which meant I had a little cabin about 8 by 8 feet tin under the Broadway Bridge in Hollywood, if you know where the Elysian Park is. And I was down there, and I was so joyful to have the job. But after a while, the novelty wore off. I was now speaking in AA, and I would come away from the meeting, and then I'd put on my big boots and go down there and march along the tracks. I felt like Cinderella. You know, at midnight, I was turning into a pumpkin. And I thought, well, how do I get out from here? Because I realized it really wasn't apt to be that some large law firm or some corporation looking for house counsel after midnight might be driving over the Broadway Bridge and say, "Suppose we go down there and look for, you know." And I realized I'd have to get up and expose myself to this thing. Because I realized the Serenity Prayer doesn't say it is more serene to accept than courageously change. It just says you have to do one or the other. And so I thought, I'll go into one law firm and make an application. If it hurts too much, I won't go anymore that week. I used to tell that story as if that's how I got out from under the Broadway Bridge. It wasn't. I got out from under the Broadway Bridge because I kept speaking and active in AA. And one night, 3 in the morning, one of the phones rang. And it was a guy who'd heard me give a talk and wanted me to come out and try a case for him. I mean, the higher power goes in and gets you. But to apply for a job was very difficult because I had been around AA long enough to know that our stories can be the source of innocent merriment. But I didn't know that non-alcoholics won't understand the humor. So I was applying for this job, and I remember I told the guy a couple of light stories about how I got drunk, threw my mother-in-law down the steps or something, you know, and being intoxicated, fell after, got a hernia. And he didn't giggle a gig, titter a titty, just kind of stared. And so I thought, well, I'm perhaps too subtle for him. So I told him about the time I was in 4-point restraint and vomited straight up. And that got a reaction. And I said, well, look, I'm not asking you to recommend me. He said, recommend you? Recommend you? I wouldn't offer your name for consideration. No attorney in the history of this nation has ever done the things you've done or had happen to him, the things that have happened to you. Forget the law. Go into the countryside. Try to regain your health and simple labor. He said, when members of this law firm go into a courtroom, they represent strength in the face of adversity, determination, and grit. Send you? Never. I was crushed. I mean, I'll tell you, I was not ready for that. If I could have slithered like a serpent across the floor into the door to drown the shame of that in that bottomless bottle like I always had, I'd have done it. But I thought, if I do, he'll be right. I can't take it. And I won't give that fellow the satisfaction. I went out and drank coffee at him. About 10 years later, he flipped out, cold sober, took a check protector, one of the secretaries, ran to Paris, disgraced his law firm, disgraced the legal profession, disgraced his family, the city of Pasadena. One of the most beautiful pyrotechnic displays of misconduct I ever saw, he did it cold sober. And about 14 or 15 years ago now, I guess, the governor of our state called me and told me he was appointing me to the appellate bench. As far as I know, the highest judicial office ever held by a sober alcoholic, at least in the state of California. You know what? No. You know what happens now when I enter a courtroom and members of that law firm come in? They stand up and they remain standing till I tell them they can be seated. All power to the powerless. I was telling Francine 40 years ago the Supreme Court was meeting to decide what to do with me, and now I sit on our Supreme Court sometimes. 7 of us in our black robes, 6 deadly serious inwardly and outwardly, 1 serious outwardly and inwardly, thinking, oh Christ, if they could see me at the clubhouse tonight. I try to take myself lightly and my work seriously, and that seems to be the best way that we'll go. I am still strange down at the court to a degree because our program takes over our whole life. You know, everything we do, we even recognize the way we speak. You know, we have now litany. You're walking into a grocery store and somebody bumps you at the counter. Oh, no, first things first. Oh, no, easy does it. Oh, you know, friend of the world. You know, and that's the way I am. Even in my written, see, when I write a decision now, if I decide to publish it, it becomes binding law on 32 million people. It appears in every law library in the United States. And I find AA stuff creeping in there. You know, in the law, we say things like, his complaint sounds in tort, or it sounds in contract. I don't know why. Blackstone said it 4 centuries ago. We thought it was cute. So we say it that way. It sounds in. I mean, you're trying to state a cause of action in that field. I wrote one that published that said, appellate's complaint sounds in self-pity and resentment, but states no cause of action known to the law. You know, I used to boast about what a good father I was, about how every Sunday I took my children out for a drunk drive. And I wrote a decision that began, appellate one morning, we're out for a drunk drive. You know, I got a call from the newspapers. I even had one that said, in law as in life, half measures avail us nothing. My colleagues say, where do you get those phrases? I don't know. You know, they just pop there. And I've even used that line that I used a little bit ago that the other guy didn't understand. You know, sometimes everybody's excited because we have an emergency writ coming in, and I'm relatively calm, and they say, how can you be so calm, Don? We got to get an order out here. Well, no matter what happens, it won't be as bad as that time I was in 4-point restraint and vomited straight up. You know, well, that's probably true, but I don't think I'd have thought of it in quite that way. So, don't give up hope, any of us. The things that have happened to us have been necessary, and we don't know what we're being prepared for. But the main thing I'm urging now is get out and get it on. And for God's sakes, do it to excess if you possibly can. Yeah. Life is to be lived. I mean, I'm of the Oscar Wilde school. Nothing succeeds like excess. Yeah. Let the moderation be for the non-alcoholic. Was it Socrates who said, in media res, the middle way? So when he drank hemlock, he wasn't losing a hell of a lot. Yeah. Get it on. And you've got to do it right now. I mean, there is no other time. If you want to strike a blow for justice, improve society, do it now. Nobody raises their hand for righteousness' sake in the tomb or any other place. And if you want to do something tender, loving, gentle, lewd, lurid, you got to do that now too. A poet said, the grave, it is a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace. It has to be done right now. Final poet said, the bird of time has but a little way to flutter, and the bird is on the wing. My bird doesn't have very much longer to fly, and I'm not going to miss a single beat of those wings if I possibly can, and I just hope even you young people will stick around and we'll fly together. Thank you.